This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Maple sugaring connects us to the trees that surround us, and the process produces a delicious, sweet product. Maple syrup, of course. But it can also cause its fair share of headaches, like when you have to battle rugged terrain, bad weather, and plundering woodland creatures to get that sap that you want so much. Peter Gregg knows a thing or two about that. In his memoir, The Sugar Rush, published this summer, he tells the story of how he and his longtime best friend fell in love with sugaring. Peter runs a 1,000-tap sugaring operation in Rupert, Vermont. He's also the longtime publisher of the Maple News, the largest trade magazine for the maple syrup industry in the U.S. and Canada. And he splits his time between New York and Vermont. Peter, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're so glad to have you. And listeners, while we are talking sugaring, you can join the conversation too. For you, is making maple syrup a hobby, a living, or a way of life? Give us a call and tell us about it. 800-639-2211 is our number. You can also email us your thoughts to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. All right, Peter, first off, what was the yield like this past spring?
Ooh, we're going to talk about this year because it wasn't so great for me. Yeah, the weather for me didn't cooperate, and I just fell behind. I tapped too late, actually, this year, which was a mistake. It's always a crapshoot on when to tap your trees, and this year I gambled wrong, and I lost, and it was kind of miserable, and the weather wasn't great. The weather today, actually, was like the weather all through February and March.
I remember. Yeah, it was rough. It was a
miserable.
Dark time for me, too.
Yeah, so it was not that great. But the year I write about in the book is 2022, and that was a pretty good year. I don't want to, you know, spoiler alert, but but it was a pretty good year. And 2023 actually was a fabulous year for me. This year, not so great. But the sugar makers in northern Vermont did really, really well this year. It was one of their best years ever. So overall, Vermont did very well.
All right. Well, let's back way up to the beginning of your maple addiction. You are not to reveal you too much, but you are a Flatlander from Minnesota.
Yeah.
When and why did you first move to Vermont?
I came to Vermont for college. So I went to Castleton State College, as it was called then. It's now Vermont State University.
That's right.
They've changed the name like twice already since I left, but it was great. And I didn't know a thing about maple syrup. I was an Aunt Jemima guy. I hate to admit it. I grew up in the suburbs of Minneapolis, so I have no business actually doing what I'm doing now. I'm no farmer. I'm not a naturally born farmer, you know, but I came to Vermont. I fell in love with sugaring. I got kind of introduced to it, and it, you know, I started making a couple buckets in the backyard, and the addiction took hold, and it just grows from there. And that's how it works for everyone. We call it the bug. You know, you start sugaring, you know, in the backyard, and, you know, the next thing you know, you're adding more trees. You're knocking on the neighbor's door asking them if you can tap their trees. And you're buying land, and you're buying equipment. And, you know, before you go broke, you try to make as much syrup as you can and keep up with everybody else. It's a lot of fun, though.
A literal slippery slope.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good way putting it, for sure.
So you started in college, or you just learned about sugaring when you moved here?
I learned about sugaring in college, yeah. And then it wasn't too long after I kind of got into my adult life, so to speak, that I had a buddy that made syrup, and I went and hung out with him one Saturday afternoon, kind of a beer-fueled day sitting in his sugar house, you know, but I just, he let me kind of take over the evaporator at one point, and I was like, wow, this is some pretty cool stuff. And it would just, you know, so the next day he gave me a hydrometer cup and a couple of buckets. So a hydrometer cup and a hydrometer, that's how we measure the density of syrup. And he said, I want you to give it a try. I can see that you loved it. You should give it a try at home. And so I did, and just took off from there.
Oh, wow. So if you could take us back to that moment when you were first, you know, looking at this evaporator, or you get your own hydrometer cup, what exactly was it about the process that really lured you in?
it hits all your senses at once. It's you know, it's just an engrossing kind of experience, you know. So there's this steam. Most of us probably listening have been in a sugar house. We kind of know, we have a general idea, you know, talking to Vermonters, so that's kind of nice. You know, we have a general idea what it's like, but I mean, there's steam, there's the aroma of cooking sugar, you know.
It's the just best takes smell over. In the world.
It is the best smell in the world. So when it's just the ambiance and being outside, and it just stimulates all the senses at once, and it just, that's what I think for me does it for sure. Plus I like being outside, so the great part about sugaring is it shakes off those kind of winter blahs. It gets you outside and moving after you've been sitting on your couch watching football for, you know, 6 or 8 weeks or whatever, you know. At least that's how it is for me, you know. And then you get out in the woods and start trouncing around, and you gets the blood flowing, and you're outside in the air, and then when you're boiling sap, I mean, that's just a great experience. And all the neighbors come around and hang out, and it's just a special, special time of year. So in Vermont, you know, there's really only, we're the only kind of region in the world practically that does this. I mean, the sugar maple really only grows between Minnesota and Maine, and that's it, and really the globe. So we have a really special thing here.
Minnesota, where you're originally from. So have you, now that you've gotten into sugaring, have you learned more about the sugaring industry as it exists in your home state, too?
Oh, back in Minnesota?
Yeah,
they're just catching on out there. They just are starting to realize that they have trees, and they're like, oh, maybe you should go tap those. You know, they got the accents. So so they do, and but they don't have the sophistication and the centuries of experience as we do here in Vermont.
But I'm going to send this to your relatives.
No,
watch out. You get some emails.
No, they get it. Yeah, I mean, they have, you know, a maple association out there in Minnesota, and they invite the Vermonters out there to talk to them and share the experience, or their experience and their expertise a lot. So they're catching on, but they're good. They're hard workers out there. There's a lot of, you know, kind of farming culture for sure in Minnesota, and they're taking right to it. And there's a lot of trees. They don't have the hills, but they do have plenty of trees out there, yeah.
Well, if you are also a sugar maker, tell us who taught you the tools of the trade, or tell us where you get your maple syrup from. We'd love to hear this hour. 800-639-2211. So you told us about catching the bug, Peter. What exactly is the timeline from, having one tree to becoming a legit syrup producer?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm there yet. And I've been doing it for 20-something years or whatever. I'm still probably, I have 1,000 taps. So, you know, they would classify people like me as a hobbyist, really. So I'm doing it more for fun than I am to make a living, you know. So, but, you know, the great thing about having a hobby like this is, you know, you could have worse hobbies. Let's just put it that way. You could be into snowmobiles, for example, where you spend a tremendous amount of money on equipment. And if it doesn't snow, it sits in the garage. Even if it does snow and you're using it, you're still spending money to maintain it and ride it around and all that.
Snowmobilers, you too can call in and yell at our guest, Peter Gregg, 800-639-2211.
But the sugar, you know, to make syrup as a hobby, you're spending a ton of money on equipment, and it is expensive. Yeah. But you're selling a product that you made, and you're making a little money back. So there's not too many hobbies where you make a little money back. So it kind of is fun in that regard. But I hope to, because I have my, the kind of the theme of the book is I kind of wanted to keep up with the big time sugar makers up here in northern Vermont, even though I only had 1,000 taps. And the best way to do that is kind of my per tap average. So the big sugar makers up here in northern Vermont, they all kind of compare themselves with how much syrup they make on average per tree in their woods. Okay. And the way they do that is they measure it in the volume they produce by in pounds, okay? So they call themselves 5-pounders. If they make 5 pounds of syrup per tap on average in a season, that's kind of the benchmark. And that's the benchmark I try to hit in my book. That's the story I tell. It's the kind of the chronicle of me trying to really kind of keep up with the Joneses, so to speak, with the big Vermont sugar makers. And you know, I won't spoil how I do. I get close, let's just put it that way. But it takes a tremendous amount of effort. In the book, I have to make, you know, the theme, I have to make twice as much syrup as I ever have before, all right? So that means working twice, 3 times as hard as I ever had before.
Yeah.
But it was kind of a sense of pride, and this is what, you know, sugar makers do.
How do you maximize the amount of sap that comes out of a tree? What are some of the tactics?
Well, the tactics are, you know, employing technology. And there's so much more technology available to us in the maple industry now than there was even 10 years ago, 15 years ago, mainly through vacuum. Okay, so we don't use buckets anymore for the most part. I mean, some people do, but for the most part now we use pumps and pipeline. Okay, so you see all that blue tubing running through the woods in Vermont. You know, we connect the tree to tree with, you know, plastic tubing through the woods. And then we hook it up to a giant high-powered pump at the bottom of the hill and basically suck the sap down the hill. And so the idea there to get more sap is to make sure that pipeline has no leaks. And to do that, you got to walk those lines. And it's miles and miles for some people. For me, it's still a lot of hiking, and all of it's vertical, up and down, chasing leaks and these little teeny holes that, you know, can kill your vacuum. And the holes come from squirrels. Okay. Mm. So the squirrels, their little teeth, they, for some reason, no one knows why, they like to chew on our tubing. And that's what creates leaks. So you have to every day go out and try to find the leak and all those miles of pipeline, one little tooth hole from a squirrel that's making your vacuum drop to nothing. Mm. So that's kind of the strategy.
Were there any other critters that you had to contend with out there among the trees, or are squirrels the biggest helion?
Well, every sugar maker has a critter that seems to harass them the most. Okay, so some squirrels, definitely the number one, you know, villain. And then, but bears, deer sometimes, porcupines, there's every critter that's in the woods for some reason likes to chew on our tubing, and no one knows. You'd think that they, you know, they like the sweetness, but they chew on our tubing year round. So even when there's not sap on the line, in the lines, they're still chewing on it. Mm. Who knows why? But it's just one of the hazards that we deal with. And then a bear is another one. I actually just saw a bear in my woods 2 weeks ago. So wow. I didn't know I had bears. It was a mama bear and her cub. And so now that is makes me a little nervous.
Good to know.
Yeah,
good information to have.
So we're carrying around, this is so funny, now we're carrying around air horns with us when we're walking in the woods. Okay, this is supposedly going to work. I don't know. I'm hopefully just going to be able to run really fast if the bear gets mad at me. But air horns are supposed to scare off these bears. So I literally have an air horn.
Oh boy.
Yeah. So, but I haven't seen her lately. But I did see her about 2 weeks ago from a distance, and I was in my truck, actually. It was right when I was pulling into the sugar house, and there she was, and Wow. She kind of took off, yeah.
Wow. Well, if you have any tips out there for contending with bears or questions about sugaring, maple syrup, or sap, you can call 800-639-2211 or email vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. We're speaking with Peter Gregg, the author of a new memoir called The Sugar Rush. We just got a question via email from a listener named Jay in Hardwick, who writes, I love the taste of pure sap. It's refreshing and just lightly sweet. I've always wondered, is there a market for the sap itself? Peter, do you know?
Yeah, there's people that are trying to bottle it up and sell it as a beverage. There's been quite a few. There's a couple outfits in Vermont that have actually taken a shot at that. And their name is not coming to me off the top of my head, unfortunately. But there's actually quite a few people that are canning either sap, or they're treating it somehow with carbonation in a lot of cases. And they're working on making that a bigger product, for sure. If the beverage industry ever got a hold of maples, kind of, we'd run out of trees. It's really, that's the kind of the, a lot of people feel the future, the growth of our industry is through the beverage side.
Yeah.
So we'll see how they do. But yeah, sap is delicious. I drink it all the time. When it comes out of the tree, it's about 98% water and 2% sugar. So it is very sweet when it comes out of the tree. So it's delicious to drink raw, certainly, and we do it all the time.
Yeah, I've had a sap seltzer, and they are very good.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, me too. They are very good. Delicious.
Well, let's pause here for a short break. When we come back, though, Peter, I want to talk a little bit about not just the sugaring process, but the relationship that's at the core of this book, you and your best friend, Bert. Let's hold on that for just a moment, though. Again, you can email us at vermontedition@vermontpublic.org with any questions for our guest today, Peter Gregg. Stay with us. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. If you're just joining us, our guest today is Peter Gregg, author of the memoir, The Sugar Rush. It's a story of best friendship set against the backdrop of a thousand-tree tapping operation in the shadow of Rupert Mountain in Bennington County. 800-639-2211 is our number. Call in and tell us your favorite use for maple syrup or where you learned the art of sugaring from. Maybe there's a special person in your life who passed down that knowledge. So, Peter, tell us about Bert.
Bert is my best friend who I kind of recruit to be part of this venture of mine to match up with the big Vermonters to make 5 pounds of syrup per tap. I can't do it by myself. And so I kind of, you know, lure him into this escapade. And in the book kind of turns into a comedy from there. So we're both he's kind of a flatlander too. And Bert's not his real name. He didn't want his real name used, but he's.
Did he get to pick the name Bert?
No, I picked it because Bert sounds funny, actually. It's a, no offense to the Berts out there, but it's a good name for him.
It's a great name.
Yeah. So, and it fits his personality for sure. So I'm more high strung and he is way more sensible and he's kind of the smarter of the two of us. But I'm the one that's kind of gung ho to kind of hit this goal. So I kind of got to drag him along a little bit. But it's also the book is kind of a celebration of our friendship. So, and I kind of really wanted to, you know, it's kind of a buddy movie in a way. Remember, you know, mm-hmm. It's like if Smokey and the Bandit was a book about maple syrup, this is the book it would be. It's kind of, I mean, it's, you know, I don't know if you've heard this, but there's something called a friendship recession going on in America.
No.
They've written about it here and there, and especially for men. We're not maintaining friendships or making friends as much as men in our older lives as generations before, and it's almost like at crisis levels, according to some university studies. And I don't know. I wouldn't suggest that everyone start a maple operation to make new friends, but this is the circumstances I found myself in, and with Bert, you know, just us doing something side by side together, you know, kind of just brings the bonds of friendship together. That's actually kind of how they've researched men do kind of bond, is doing things side by side almost, you know, going to a baseball game together or, you know, I don't know. That's just how they kind of describe how male friendships are made. And so we're working side by side in the woods and, you know, and in the sugar house. And it just, you know, it's a good way to bring friends together.
Peter, we're going to have you back on for a show that I have been wanting to do now about best friendship that we were just talking about yesterday, actually, with a couple of producers about,
nice.
Especially about male friendships. And this is perfect. So we'll put a pin in that.
Sounds good.
So you, besides Bert, you met a lot of interesting characters in your sugaring ventures. Tell us more about some of the folks that you kind of came across and got to know through this process.
Yeah, that's almost the best. My favorite part of writing about is telling, you know, sharing about these characters, these casts. I can't do this alone. Me and Bert can't do this together. Almost we need help from our neighbors. You know, I'm a flatlander. I come from the suburbs of Minneapolis. And meanwhile, all my neighbors who make syrup have been doing this all their lives. And one of the great things about sugaring is we all go out of our way to help each other out. Mm-hmm. We share information with each other freely. I mean, if you go to a maple conference, we're all just, you know, swapping ideas on how to make more syrup and how to improve. And then, you know, if we get in trouble, you know, someone will come to help you out. And I'm the one that requires the most amount of help because I'm the least mechanically inclined, the least, you know, equipped to be doing what we're doing. So I have a neighbor who makes syrup right down the lane where I live. You know, we're on a dirt road called Blossom Road, and there's a big sugar maker at the end of the Blossom Road that he comes and bails us out quite a bit. But there's other sugar makers that when my equipment breaks, I don't know how to fix it. So there's other sugar makers that come and help me, like with my RO machine, for example, blew up on us. And so he raced to the rescue and helped us get back and back on track and back in order. But there's other sugar makers too. That there's one sugar maker, we call him Shaky. He kind of makes syrup. For him, making syrup is kind of a party. Okay. So he's in the sugar house and he's kind of has a lot of, you know, beer positivity kind of a policy in his sugar house, you know, and for him making syrup is fun and it's supposed to be fun. And he reminds me all the time that if it's this, if you're not having fun, then you shouldn't be doing it. And then there's other sugar makers that are very, very hardcore. And it's like, you know, no beer in the sugar house for sure is a rule. This one sugar maker, his name was Rasher. He was kind of my mentor, actually. And he said, you know, no beer in the sugar house for sure. Because, you know, when you're, you know, boiling sap with a fire as hot as the underworld, you know, you don't want to have your senses. You want to be at the, you know, the top of your game, you know. And so we're not messing around here. We're doing something. We're making food, for one. And two, we're working with, you know, some pretty intense equipment. With some very, very hot fire. 1,200 degrees is usually what my fire temperature is. You know, so, you know, you want to be on your toes and know what you're doing and be alert and really take it seriously. So there's that kind of, I have those, both those guys on both sides of my shoulders kind of speaking to me in each ear. You know, it's fun, but you're taking, take it seriously, you know, and that's kind of how I roll. So when I'm making syrup, I try to have fun, but I've definitely work hard to do it right.
Yeah. Well, speaking of everything that it takes to create syrup, you spend a lot of the book talking about gear. Were you a gear guy by nature before this process?
No, but I've but I've definitely grown to appreciate all the gear. So there is a lot of there's certainly a lot of equipment. A lot of it's made in Vermont. There's a you know up in Franklin County is kind of the epicenter of equipment manufacturing and sales. That's where the biggest sugar makers are. But, you know, people flock from really all over the nation to go to the big maple stores. They're almost like Walmarts, really, of maple. They're up in Swanton and St. Albans and whatnot. So, and there's a lot of gear. I mean, there's just an endless amount of equipment that goes, you know, certainly the evaporator, which is the most important part, you know, but all your tubing, your pumps, RO, reverse osmosis machines, which remove some of the water from the sap before you have to boil it, and so on. So, and then there's all kinds of other accoutrements that go along with it. But yeah, it's a gear-centric industry for sure, which is cool.
Yeah. That's awesome. We have a controversy on our hands, Peter.
Okay.
And we just got an email from a listener named Joy who says that they noticed that I pronounce syrup like syrup, but Joy pronounces it syrup. What is the right one, they ask. Peter, since you are our guest, you are going to be our judge today.
Well, a lot of the farmers just call it syrup. Syrup. Almost like S-U-R-P, syrup.
I think I would be called out for a fraud if I started doing that.
But I have not, I don't know, I don't have it nailed down. Let's go with, I always say, how do I don't even know how I say it. Syrup. I say syrup.
Oh, shoot. Yeah. All right, Joy.
You say syrup?
Well, don't look at me like that.
I don't know. Okay, tomato, tomato.
All right, well, again, call it 800-639-221, vote syrup or syrup or something else. This is the news of the day.
This wasn't the question I was expecting. That's
I know,
a good one.
I know. You never know what people are going to say. So you have grown your operation quite substantially over the years that you've been doing this. You have 1,000 taps right now.
Yes.
Are you envisioning continued growth or are you, no pun intended, tapped out? Is this the max that you can do?
Definitely tapped out. Yes, you know, I've ran out of trees.
So, okay, well that'll
you know,
do it.
So that I've got every one of them tapped, and all my neighbors' trees are tapped. So, and that is how it is in Vermont and New York and New Hampshire, and you know, kind of the core areas of sugaring is we're all fighting for every tree. Actually, there's, you know, it good sugar bush is hard to find now. So it's and you know, there's a lot of competition to find trees, especially in Vermont. I mean, and especially northern Vermont. I mean, they're just, you know, so they a lot of folks rent trees or lease trees from their neighbors, or they find big property swaths and tap them and rent and pay a rent per tree. Hmm. And so in southern Vermont, the lease rates are like $1 per tree. But up here in north, in Franklin County and Lamoille County and whatnot, $2, $2.50, $3 a tree is some of the rents. You know, so there's a lot of competition to get at the sugar maples, for sure, that are accessible, you know, that are close to roads,
right,
you know, that aren't, you know, too treacherous to get at.
Yeah. Well, let's go to the phones. We have Thomas calling in from Bellis Falls. Thomas, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, good afternoon. Great to hear this. I have an interesting history with sugaring. I had a 120-acre farm in Gilmanton, New Hampshire, and the previous people that had the farm used to tap trees because there was a big sugar bush area, and it was elevation, so it was perfect. So I decided to do some tapping and make some syrup for my five kids, and did it the first year in the kitchen, and their mother said never again after the wallpaper was
oh no
walls. That's classic. And
so I had a friend who did sugaring in Gilmanton, and he wound up I asked if he wanted a tap. He wound up putting about 1,200 taps in, and then I could have all the syrup I wanted. And I used to bring it when I go back over to Ireland to visit my family, because they loved it. They never got it. They'd put it on mashed potatoes. They'd put it on everything. And this was during the Troubles, and I would go up to the north. And one time I was coming when I had, I don't know, 24 small containers, and I was crossing the border, and the British soldiers stopped me. And, you know, they saw it, and they wanted to know what it was. They were concerned it might be, you know, inflammable or whatever. And I said, no, it's maple syrup. And I opened one up, and they tried it. And then I had to give 6 of them each a container to be able to go on up to Belfast.
Oh, my gosh. What a tariff, Thomas. That is great. Thanks so much for calling in. I love that story.
That's a great one. Well, that is the – all right, so that he is right on the money with that. That is the – what we are making syrup delights people, you know? So that's one of the kind of the great things about doing it. One of the reasons why I like doing it is because, you know, the end product – delights people, you know, you just brings people joy. Certainly my family and friends, just like he said, you know, hooking up his family with syrup, you're a hero, you know, especially Christmas, you know, it's a great Christmas gift, you know, but wherever you go, I'm kind of like, you know, with all my civilian friends and my non-maple friends, you know, I'm the maple guy. And they're like, you got any syrup? I ran out of syrup. Can I have some more syrup? You got any more of that awesome syrup? You know, it just goes, and you know, very, very popular. So it's a nice kind of, you know, part of my identity to be the maple guy, especially back in Minnesota. They all love it there.
Well, there is, it sounds like, some PR left to be done. We just got an email from Carl in Johnson who says, when I first moved to Vermont, I told a Vermonter that in the rest of the country, most people just use maple syrup for pancakes. He looks like he was about to cry. let's go next to Bernie in Rutland. Bernie, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, what a great program, guys. And Mikhail, you can call it whatever you want.
Thank you, Bernie.
Pronounce it however you want. It's something Vermonters are proud of. I know the Sugars are proud of it. And it's a special Vermont product. And I've been to many sugar makers here in Rutland County. I just wanted to give a shout out to Baird Farm, which is in North Chittenden, which is just a special place as well. And we're lucky to have it all. Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks, Bernie.
I love that farm. Yeah, the Baird, Bob Baird, Jenna, his daughter, they are doing a wonderful job. It's a great place to visit. They are doing, and they're kind of a big part of a trend, they do a lot of value added with maple. So they have, for example, this unbelievable maple ketchup that I've bought from Baird Farm.
That sounds good.
Oh, it's unbelievable. Yeah. So, but they do all, you know, barbecue sauces, but, you know, maple coated nuts, maple cream, maple candy. I mean, the list goes on. There's virtually probably hundreds of products that could be made value added, they call
sure.
it. And that's really another big part of you know, along with we were talking before, sap beverages or whatever, but value-added products, certainly the future for maple. It's just really catching on, and people are being more and more creative in their uses of maple and marketing it. And Baird Farm in particular, they're very, very good at that.
Mm. Can I let you out a little secret of maple use? In college, we used to do a shot of whiskey followed by a shot of maple syrup. It's the perfect chaser.
Yes. Well, that sounds good. Well, I mean, yeah, the maple liquor, maple-based vodkas, for example. I visited a farm in Vermont that's doing that. Maple-based beers, that's another big thing. Yeah, I mean, the list goes on and on. So it's a very versatile base for so many different products.
Well, let's take a couple more calls. We have Anne in Waterbury on the line. Anne, go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, so nice to have this show. It's a fun show, and maple is good for everything.
Amen.
So last year, my husband, who's a granddad, and his grandson, who's 14, decided that they would sugar for the first time. We have about 10 really great maple trees in our yard that have never been tapped. So they went to town on it, and they did a really nice job until grandson had to go home to school the next day, and granddad's looking at me saying, "You're up at bat." So, 2 o'clock in the morning, I'm getting the, shake on the shoulder. You got to get up. I can't read the thermometer to tell me if it's ready. So what I'm really looking for is tips for the home sugar maker so that I can stay sane this coming season. And they did get some nice syrup out of it. They really did. Quality obviously varies, right? But more to the point, when we talk about the joy of syrup, that bonding experience was really incredible.
Thank you, Anne.
Yeah, for sure. I agree with everything she said. And if you want to make it at home, we'll start earlier in the day, maybe boiling, because it takes a long time when you're just boiling raw sap, as we call it. So when you're trying to when it comes out of the tree, the sap, 98% water, 2% sugar. But by the time we're done boiling it, we're trying to get it up to about 66% sugar and 33% water. So that it takes a long time to get it to that process, sure. Especially if you're doing it in your kitchen or in the backyard over on cinder blocks in a pan. Some people do it that way, or even I've seen people put pots on a barbecue grill. There's many different ways, but it takes a long time. So prepare to boil for 12, 14, 16 hours at a time. But when you do, you're kind of earning your credibility, paying your dues in maple. I've done that. Back in the day, sugar makers would go 36 hours at a time boiling. This is before our oak technology, which helps speed up the process tremendously. Before that, if you had a big sap run, it could last 3 straight days and you wouldn't go to sleep. You would be at the evaporator boiling for 3 straight days. And I've heard many, many stories from old-time sugar makers that have done that.
Wow.
But as part of your earning your cred, so to speak, if you're going to make maple syrup, you're going to have to sit there and boil it for a little while to learn how it's done.
Yeah. Well, good luck, Anne. I hope this time goes a little more smoothly than the last. Bill in Dummerston is on the line. Bill, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. I don't want to sound like Donnie Downer or something like that, but I'm reminded when I used to teach school, I would tell the students there's 3 sides to every story. There's your side, there's my side, and the truth. I've heard all the positives about sugaring, and believe me, I love maple syrup. But what are some of the negative impacts of maple syrup? This man talked earlier about 5 powders. Well, a pound of maple syrup weighs almost 10 pounds, so you multiply that by 5,000-6,000 taps, and you're taking out hundreds of thousands of gallons of water out of the ground that the trees must then suck back up in order to stay alive. And the reason I'm mentioning this is several of my neighbors have called on me lately to help them with their wells because they're going dry. So I would like to know if there's been any studies that indicate how the impact of this much sugaring, which I think is honestly, especially since the advent of reverse osmosis, they're getting more. Right. Sap out of a gallon than ever before. I'd like to know the impact of that on our aquifer.
Yeah, Bill, that's a great question. Sorry to cut you off there. I apologize, but let's throw this to our guest, Peter Gregg.
Well, our pumps aren't that powerful. We're not sucking water out of their wells. I appreciate what he's saying, though. I think what he's wondering is if we're taking too much sap out of the tree. And so the University of Vermont has a research center not far from here in Underhill on the side of Mount Mansfield, and they've done all kinds of research on how much sap does the tree really need and how much sap are we taking out, and it's a very, very small percentage, it turns out. So, a fraction of what is pumping through those trees is what we're taking out. So if you think of it, a maple tree, it's really kind of a bundle of straws, like drinking straws. And we're just tapping like one of those bundles that are inside the trunk of a tree for the most part. So the trees are doing fine. Trust me, we pay closer attention to our trees than anybody. I mean, we want our trees to be in good health. And we pay very, very close attention to their health and do everything we can to maintain.
And the surrounding land's doing all right too?
Absolutely. Yeah. So my trees, have been tapped for Well, I've been tapping them for 20-something years, and they look very great this year, actually. You know, but people in Vermont have been, some families have been tapping the same exact tree since the Civil War. I mean, that's, some of these big monster maples are 150, 175 years old, and they're still tapping them every year, and they always have.
Yeah.
And they're doing fine, so.
We have just about a minute left, but I want to squeeze in one more call from Elaine in Fairfax. Elaine, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you. I just wanted to comment on, I grew up in Vermont and from generations of sugar makers, and we're very passionate about Vermont syrup. My husband grew up in Connecticut, and he thought Connecticut maple syrup would be just as good. So we had a contest, a blind taste contest. And Vermont won hands down because it had a depth of flavor. The Connecticut syrup just tasted sweet. And my mother, who grew up on a farm in the Northeast Kingdom, said she could tell Northeast Kingdom syrup by the flavor. She said it had almost a tang to it, which is very different. So I'm just wondering about the difference in flavors of maple syrup around the state.
Thank you, Elaine.
That's a really good point, and that's true. I mean, flavor, you know, varies almost from, sometimes from day to day and farm to farm, but definitely from state to state and region to region. There's kind of a general flavor characteristic that is different from Vermont to Wisconsin, for example, has a very different kind of flavor character to it than Vermont syrup does. Quebec syrup, also very unique and different compared to Vermont syrup. Vermont versus Connecticut, I haven't heard that comparison too much or ever, but I've been to Connecticut and I have some of their syrup and it's pretty good. But, you know, if Vermont won the taste test in your house, then, you know, there you go.
We'll take it.
What can you do? Yeah.
Peter Gregg's new book is called The Sugar Rush, a memoir of wild dreams, budding bromance, and maple syrup. It came out in July from Pegasus Books. Peter, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Coming up, we are shifting from maple syrup to goat cheese. Vermont Creamery turns 40 this year. The company's co-founder joins us in just a moment on Vermont Edition. Stay with us. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. When you go to a big chain grocery store, there are a few Vermont dairy brands that you will reliably see. Ben & Jerry's, Cabot, and Vermont Creamery, maker of creme fraiche, goat cheese logs, cultured butter, and other delicious dairy products. Over the past four decades, Vermont Creamery has grown from a small artisan dairy company based in Websterville to a must-have brand for retailers like Wegmans and Whole Foods. This year, it celebrates its 40th anniversary. Vermont Creamery's co-founder, Allison Hooper, joins us today to mark that milestone. Her family also owns and operates Ayersbrook Goat Dairy in Randolph, which produces milk for the creamery. She's also the founding president of the Vermont Cheese Council. Allison, welcome.
Welcome. Welcome. It's great to be here. Thank you, Michaela.
And I feel like listeners should know you just pulled a hunk of cheese out of your purse. So
I know.
On brand.
Right. I got it through security. Smell and all, right? It's rather aromatic.
We'll wait to open it in this studio. And listeners, if you are a Vermont Creamery fan or just love using goat cheese in your kitchen, maybe you make it yourself, tell us about it. Call in at 800-639-2211. So, Allison, you founded this company 40 years ago alongside Bob Reese. Tell us about 1984, Allison Hooper.
1984, you did not see various brands of goat cheese in the supermarket. I grew up in New Jersey. I went to France, lived on a farm, made cheese, charcuterie, butter, all those wonderful things like creme fraiche. And I thought, oh, we don't have this in the United States. And a few years later, I moved to Vermont thinking that in the back of my mind that there might be cheesemaking in my future. Vermont seemed like an appropriate place to do that. And while working at the Agency of Agriculture, I met Bob Reese. He was a marketing director. He asked me to make cheese for a dinner for a chef. And I made the cheese. And the two of us really didn't know each other. And we thought, okay, let's start a business. I had cheeses that I wanted to make, and he had just finished getting an MBA and was helping Vermonters package their recipes and bring them to the market. And it was a very early in the specialty food industry in Vermont. And so off we went, couple of naive 20-somethings, clueless, absolutely clueless.
So was there a market niche that you were trying to fill, or were you hoping to create that market?
There was no market. Okay. If we had done a market study, it would have said, no, there's no point in trying this. Nobody eats goat cheese. Nobody knows how to say creme fraiche. And nobody knows what cultured butter is. So forget it. Now, we had to create the market. And we did that alongside maybe a half a dozen other producers around the country, very similar to our story, very sort of organically had a crazy idea. Undercapitalized, and we all started this around the same time.
Do you remember any epic fails from those early days? Any terrible cheese? Any cheese smelling not the way you want stinky cheese to smell?
Oh, let's just say we kept a lot of pigs very happy in the early years. Yeah. No, there are many, many failures, and that's just to be expected. When I think of a really epic business failure, doing everything on a shoestring, we decided that we were going to retrofit a steam boiler from the Gifford Hospital in Randolph, Vermont, and put it in our new creamery and make it into a water boiler, and we got it all finished, all plumbed, everything perfect. Except that the state boiler inspector said, well, you can't make cheese in this building because this is, you can't convert this boiler. So we were basically really in a pickle. Bank pulled the plug on us, and we had to find a new bank and refinance and on
you
goes the story.
Work.
Made it work. You got to keep moving. Yeah. Oh, that's a good failure.
Tell us about how you built relationships with customers in the early days, because not only there wasn't really a market for what you were selling yet, but I mean, this is the 80s and 90s. You're not shooting off a 100 emails in a day.
No emails.
Yeah.
Not even fax machines weren't invented then either. We started out by having a small stand at the Norwich Farmers Market. And there were a few customers, Dartmouth professors who maybe were French or Italian and knew about some of these types of cheeses, and they would buy from us. But generally, people would look across the field and think, oh, gosh, there's a young woman over there selling cheese, and it's goat cheese. Doesn't sound very good. So we quickly, as we were going out of business doing that, realized that we needed to go to New York and Boston, where all the best restaurants were run by French chefs, and they were very welcoming. They basically said, look, we love our French products, but if you make something that is comparable and as good, we're going to buy it from you. And so they did. And for years, that was how we kept our business going, is selling to these butter and egg distributors in New York City and Boston.
Yeah. Well, the name of the brand, Vermont Creamery, it's a perfect name, straightforward, pithy. But the brand was originally called something else, which I just learned recently, the Vermont Butter and Cheese Company.
Now, that's a mouthful.
Huh? Yeah, it's a bit of a mouthful. But I heard tell that changing the name to Vermont Creamery was a bit of an odyssey. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah. Well, this is talk about lack of branding or thoughtfulness about marketing and positioning. Bob was, I was making cheese, and he called me and said, hey, I got to go to the Secretary of State's office and register the business. We need a name. I was like, right, we need a name. Okay, so we're in Vermont. Let's call it Vermont. I'm like, good idea, Vermont. We're going to make butter and we're making cheese, so let's call it butter and cheese. Great, good idea. And we should probably call it a company so that people take us seriously and think we're a real company. So that was...
So there's no focus group
involved. No
in
focus
this.
Group, yeah. no design, nothing. Although it was highly, it's quite authentic because we did capitalize on the Vermont name. And realized people called us VBC. They called us Vermont Butter and Egg. It was so twisted over the years. And so in order to call it Vermont Creamery, we couldn't really register that name because it was too generic. And so if you use a name for a period of time, you have an opportunity to change parts of the name. So we went from Vermont Butter and Cheese Company to Vermont Butter and Cheese Creamery, and then we were allowed to drop the butter and cheese and call it Vermont Creamery. Hopefully that's the last iteration that we go through. Yeah.
Well, the business was acquired by Land O'Lakes in 2017, but it's still in many ways a very local business, a Vermont
absolutely.
Business, and a business in which your family, your kids are involved in, too. What was it like kind of making sure that the essence of what you were trying to do stayed the same, even while it was acquired by a much larger corporation?
You know, when you go through this process, you just don't have any guarantee about what can happen. Suitors will probably tell you what you want to hear. I think that what was reassuring for us with Land O'Lakes is they are a farmer-owned cooperative. They're in the business that we're in. They understand farming. They understand producing cheese, and they understand the marketplace. That was about the most we could ask for. They didn't have any outposts in the Northeast. That was something that they were interested in. But they kept the business where it is. They kept all the employees. They gave everybody raises. I mean, we thought we had great benefits, but I'll tell you what, their benefits were pretty amazing. They've brought immense resources to the brand, and it's just worked out really nicely.
Yeah. And now you're celebrating its 40th anniversary. And yeah. Alison, you have a very sticky
Isn't
cheese named after you.
The cutest thing. Yeah. So the current general manager, Harrison Kahn, Harry, called me and said, "Hey, we're celebrating our 40th anniversary. Was there any cheese that you never made?" And I said, "Well, as a matter of fact, I wanted to make a little donut-shaped cheese. Is that about the cutest thing ever?"
It's very cute.
And, you know, we for very specific
Can
reasons.
I spell it?
Yeah. Give it a rind that's a little different from everything
Ooh,
else
yeah.
that we make. Yeah. And that's a young one. And so the R&D team went right to work, and they did really just a spectacular job. And he called me and said, "Well, we've got a name, and it's Hooper." And I thought, oh, for gosh sakes, you guys are killing me. I said, "All right, just so long as all you listeners out there know that it wasn't my idea."
All right,
but
you're on the
fun.
Record now saying it. Well, lastly, Alison, I wanted to ask you about the family business. Mm. Your son Sam has actually been on the show before. He owns Vermont
yes.
Glove.
Yes, yes.
Are there any overlaps between the glove business and the cheese business?
Oh,
can
my
you
gosh.
Offer him or your other
there
kids advice?
There are so many.
Yeah.
So many. I mean, when you're – it's very lonely, you know, and it's really hard.
Yeah.
And people say, "Oh, great, you own your business. That must be so much fun." It is not fun.
It's a very uplifting segment.
Yes.
Right.
Well, you know, it's the reality, and it can be very, you have a lot of self-doubt, and
yeah.
I just tell him, you got to trust your gut. You know, people are going to give you all kinds of advice, and you got to listen to it. But at the end of the day, you're the one who's got to live with it, and you got to do what your heart tells you to do. And he's done that very well. And, you know, I think, he has seen the trials and tribulations, but he's also seen the rewards. So, you know, we talk all the time about gloves.
Alison Hooper is the co-founder of Vermont Creamery, which celebrates its 40th anniversary this year. Alison, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And is this a pay-to-play situation? Do I get to keep the cheese?
Yeah, you get to keep
yes.
the cheese. Those are your rules. Those
right.
aren't mine.
Well, I'm disclosing it publicly,
okay.
so y'all know.
Very good. Thank you, Michaela.
All right, that is all the time that we have for today's very delicious show. A quick reminder before we wrap up that starting next Tuesday, October 1st. We're going to be hosting a series of debates ahead of the 2024 general elections. On Tuesday, we will be speaking with the two candidates for the seat for Vermont's seat for the U.S. House of Representatives, Becca Ballant and Mark Kirster. I'll be moderating those debates, and you can submit questions for them if you have one to vote@vermontpublic.org. Today's show was directed by Liz Fullerton. Our managing producer is John Ahrens. Andrea Lorien and Daniela Fierro are our producers, and Rick Barrett was our call screener today. Meyer Flynn composed our theme music. I'm Michaela LaFrag. Thank you so much for listening, and we will catch up again soon.